Welcome to the latest edition of the NPM podcast. Joining me today is Dan Revers, founder and managing partner of Boston-based energy investor Parklight Capital Partners. Dan, welcome to the program today.
Thank you, John. Glad to be here.
Thank you. So, Parklight has been in the power development business for over two decades. It would be really great to get your perspective today on what it's going to take for these renewable independent power producers, either newly minted in recent years or older, to succeed given all the challenges they face currently.
From what we see, the IPPs in the renewable side have been really focused exclusively on growth for the last decade. And they've ridden a wave of very low interest rates and obviously booming demand for renewables to attract capital to fuel their growth. But their ROEs are really pretty low, you know, 3 to 5% at best. I think NextEra is probably an exception to that, but they benefit from their regulated revenues at FPL being sort of lumped in there. So, you know, I think public IPPs has always been a tough sell, you know, either thermal or renewable. But I think the winners as they go forward will be the ones that focus on profitability, not growth. And that's going to require them paring down portfolios and really focusing on the areas that they find to be the most profitable. Selfishly, I think that could lead to some opportunities for private capital to come in and gather some of those portfolios that are less profitable to them. And we're starting to see some of that happen already.
Great. So, you know, one thing that promised to be an accelerant in the renewable space, not only for solar, wind, and storage, but plenty of other clean energy verticals, was the Inflation Reduction Act, which got passed in August. What's your sense about where it's going to really influence the development market?
Yeah, it's happening already. We're seeing it. And you know, we're benefiting from it. We have existing sites where we can, you know, build renewable forms of energy, be it, you know, new build renewable wind or solar, or probably more likely batteries. You know, just take battery storage. You know, where the markets were relatively close to being economic, places like Texas and California, that 30% tax credit is really making a difference. And you see a market like Texas, which is going to go from less than 1.5 gigawatts operational in 2022 to something more like 4 gigawatts operational by the end of 2023, with durations of, you know, closer to 2 hours than 1 hour. So in markets where we've had a lot of renewable penetration and batteries make a lot of sense, it's making a difference, and we're seeing it, you know, ramp up significantly. In the less advantageous markets, it's making things close. You know, we're starting to see now that you know, the S&P global projections for energy storage now by 2024 on an annual basis are looking to be 7 gigawatts per year added, which is 3x the pre-IRA projection. So at least from a development project announcement standpoint, we're seeing a lot of things going on due to the IRA. Standalone battery economics as a result of the IRA, we think, could improve by as much as 5 to 10%, assuming a 30% ITC. So, you know, that's a big change for a business that was barely economic, and it makes these things, you know, viable. So I think that's where you're seeing the flood of projects at least being announced, and they're going to take some time to get built. You know, just one that was done recently in February was Olean, which is a GIP company, 200 megawatt project that received tax equity financing without any power contract. And that's, at least in my mind, one of its first of a kind. So, you know, if things like that are getting done, I think you're going to see more and more get done. And the IRA will be a big component of that.
So just in terms of, you know, your view on the duck curve today, and, you know, how far along is storage development, energy storage development, and closing that gap? What's your view there?
You know, the first stage of energy storage development was focused on the ancillary market. Ancillaries require fewer cycles. They provide a more robust return, but they didn't do anything to improve the duck curve. So, you know, what's been done in batteries so far has really not done anything. And we actually see the duck curve, you know, continue to widen as more and more renewables are built. So I think short term, you're going to see a widening duck curve, which is not what people are hoping for. And the hope is that storage is going to offset, you know, what is anticipated to be a big increase in load due to you know, electric vehicles and heating and cooling electrification. So that's going to, you know, to the extent we're migrating up the duck curve, those things are going to put another sort of obstacle in the way. So what we do see for storage is that, you know, the ancillary market opportunity will diminish or saturate over time. And they're going to rely, and storage markets can rely a lot more on energy arbitrage, which is just time shifting. You know, a less likely scenario, in my opinion, is the ISOs could increase the depth of the ancillary market and add some ancillary products to incentivize time shifting. But I think this would just be a stopgap. So overall, I think in markets like California, which is the most advanced, they're going to have to put incentives out there that really value energy ramp. And that's what ultimately fill that gap and allow batteries to fill in where the duck curve is increasing.
Great. Well, that's a natural lead into your own venture that you announced quite recently, Elevate Energy. Perhaps you can talk about the genesis behind the investment and what you're hoping to achieve there.
So, you know, about 2.5 years ago, we made a move to really step up our presence in the gas-fired market and, you know, acquired a lot of gas-fired generation from people like NRG and PSEG and the like. And these are, you know, modern combined cycles, primarily they're efficient. And we think those are going to be around for a long period of time. But they also provide highly advantaged sites for energy transition projects. You know, you've got a site where there's already power being produced. They have an interconnect. You're not always allowed to use it by right, but we're working with the ISOs to get, you know, be able to use those interconnects for storage as well as for energy production. You have permits that allow for the production and distribution of electricity from them. And so I think they're great sites. Typically in ArcLight's history, we would work with the local management team of those projects or the company that is the portfolio company that's in charge of those projects. And they would pursue those within, you know, the confines of the portfolio company. But with such a large portfolio of generation, we're about 27 gross gigs right now across the United States. We felt it was really important to bring experts in that could, you know, develop energy transition projects, you know, next to these sites on a more comprehensive basis. And that's really what Elevate is about, is to, you know, take inventory of our vast footprint around the electrical, you know, industry in the U.S. and really high grade the projects that can get to market the quickest. And I think in some instances, they'll be co-located with efficient plants that we expect to be around for decades. In other cases, they're going to take the place of an old inefficient plant that needs to retire. You know, we would like to build, own, and operate these for our own account. But in certain circumstances, there may be a better owner of that asset. So we're going to be, you know, very, you know, systematic about which ones we want to keep and which ones, you know, maybe someone else would like to buy. And certain ones aren't going to work, right? You know, the interconnect may work. There may be some cost disadvantages. So the team, I think, is coming in with a, you know, very open mind about, you know, what's possible. But very quickly, we're going to focus on the ones that are, you know, have a high probability of getting done in the near term rather than long term.
Dan, a lot of the debate about storage development kind of almost rests in a sense outside of ERCOT and CAISO, you know, where there's kind of proven markets, you know, in one sense. You know, there's obviously certain areas of Texas where there's attractive economics to build standalone storage merchant, which is where you see a lot of activity. CAISO, a lot of, you know, contracted revenue structures, which is what's gotten people to build there. But your existing portfolio of these thermal assets are obviously located in different geographies. And so I guess I wanted to get a sense about why they would be attractive for a storage development from an economic perspective.
Well, you think about, there's a big push to build renewables and call it the Northeast. Think about the push for offshore wind outside off the coast of New York and New England. PJM is a market that is pushing for more renewable development. And as we see more and more of those renewables penetrate the market, we think batteries are going to be part of the story. They have to be, particularly for things like offshore wind. So, you know, I think they'll make sense. They're not going to make sense everywhere. But, you know, being a first mover in markets, and our experience has been something that's paid off. And particularly when I think we're coming at it in a very different way, we're not throwing a bunch of capital at a team to go find sites that they can get interconnects to, that they can potentially permit and ultimately build some storage. We're doing it co-located to sites we're already, you know, operating in those markets. And I think, you know, having that operational knowledge of exactly how those markets are working and where the value-added spots to co-locate storage are is just an advantage. So, you know, we're trying to move expeditiously, but we can't move faster than the market will let us.
Right. But obviously, even having the interconnection at this point in PJM is huge, given the two-year delay that's in there currently for new applications.
Yeah, other than, you know, we don't have it by right, John. We can't just say, okay, we got a battery here, we've got an interconnect, we get to put it in here. But we are talking to the ISO about utilizing, you know, these will get to market sooner than a greenfield battery storage facility. And that's ultimately what the ISO is interested in, is getting storage up and running. So I think in some cases, we'll be able to use our existing positions to sort of advance in the queue, because we'll be able to get up and running sooner than a greenfield project.
Great, appreciate that. So let's talk about the thermal generation facilities you currently have. Be nice to just get your broader view of natural gas-fired power plants and what the shelf life looks like currently for this asset class.
You know, so we bought a couple of big portfolios, and as you might imagine, in portfolios, there's some really good stuff, there's some intermediate stuff, and there's some stuff that's not so good. So, you know, right now everything's running. You know, particularly with, you know, where the energy security now sits in people's minds. I think a couple of years ago, people were wishing gas-fired generation away in the next decade. And I think the conventional wisdom now is that it's going to be needed for a very long period of time. But, you know, you want to keep your very efficient, very clean burning plants up and running, and ultimately retire the ones that are less efficient and less clean burning. So, you know, the big combined cycles we have in Jersey, you know, one of the ones we have in Connecticut, those are sort of the plants that we expect to be around for a very long period of time, but, you know, are also opportunities to co-locate things like battery storage. We have some less efficient plants that we think the shelf life are, you know, years. And, you know, those projects, those plants are the ones that we're most likely to convert to, you know, a different either power production source and or battery storage sites. So, for example, Oswego, which is a plant we own up in New York State, you know, we're looking at developing a solar facility, you know, next to that facility, perhaps with some batteries, as that facility ultimately will wind down, not near term, but, you know, in the next 5 or 7 years. Out in the Port of Long Beach, we own a power plant that's you know, providing a lot of reliability out now in Cayuso, but long term, that site's a very valuable site for things like battery storage. Could be an interesting site for a logistical hub for hydrogen, you know, green hydrogen for transportation. So we're really taking a holistic look at the portfolio and deciding, you know, how long these plants can run. When they reach the end of the useful life, what is the best use for those sites in terms of energy transition? And in some cases, it will be nothing. It may be a better place for condos than it will be for an energy project.
Can we also talk about Sequitur and how you view the opportunities for that particular business?
Yeah, this is something we are really excited about. We've struggled to invest in wind and solar over the last decade plus. The sort of return on capital in the greenfield market has been very modest. And so it's not a place that we've been able to put a lot of money to work. And what we're seeing now as the wind business matures is that there's some opportunities arising, particularly in the smaller scale. You know, the typical onshore projects now are greater than 150 megawatts. So, you know, Sequitur is a much smaller portfolio. It's focused on sub 150 megawatt onshore wind farms that are either merchant right now, or they have short remaining contract tenors and expiring PTCs. So we want to buy these facilities and look to enhance their output, reduce their cost, and streamline the financial ownership and potentially originate, you know, commercial solutions to projects that are coming off contract. This is a very similar playbook we have used on the thermal side for almost two decades. And it's something we did a lot in Leeward Energy, which was one of our portfolio companies in Fund Five. So it's, you know, we've been looking at this for a number of years, thinking about, you know, when is this going to happen? And I think it's starting to happen, John. It's not, you know, a tidal wave yet, but we're seeing it. So I think the initial, we have 185 megawatts right now in Sequitur. We're probably going to close another 20 megawatts in California later this month. All those facilities are about 18 to 20 years old. And in Sequitur in particular, that what we have right now, about 30% of the turbines were idled awaiting maintenance capex. So, you know, literally you have wind farms that are just not even operating. And we like the existing older sites for a number of reasons. You know, one, they tend to be in the best locations for wind. You know, just like if you're drilling for oil, you drill where you see the oil bubbling out of the ground. I think when people first sighted wind farms, they look where, hey, this is a windy spot. Let's put some wind farms here. They have grid interconnections, which are obviously difficult to replicate. And, you know, they typically have some merchant and or operational problems. And these are things that we've spent a lot of time working on over the years in the thermal side. So, you know, we like the opportunity. We think there's going to be more of it. And we think the returns are going to be commensurate with what we're trying to get in our funds, which are, you know, way above the greenfield returns that we see out there today.
What do the costs look like today in repowering wind farms? And does this involve using some of like newer technologies or turbines to do that? Just curious to get your broader view on that.
So, you know, there are really two kinds of repowerings. You know, one is a full repower where the entire WTG is taken down and new towers and turbines are erected. And these are, you know, you can install something brand new and efficient. And we think those are really interesting projects. They should probably come in about 20% cheaper than a new build is in our estimation. We haven't done one yet, so that's just our estimation right now. The second is a partial repower where, you know, we're making substantial investment in upgrading the WTG. And those are, you know, much more efficient, much more cost effective, but they don't work everywhere. I think it's Sequitur in particular, with the idle turbines, it makes a lot of sense. You've got turbines that aren't operating. You're going to go and put some capital in them to get them operating. And I think the partial repower makes sense. There's some super advantageous sites within the Sequitur portfolio where it probably makes sense to do a full rebuild, which we think we can get done. You know, it's somewhere, you know, let's just call it 15 to 20% cheaper than new build because you have the site set up, you've got concrete pads and the like, you've got electrical interconnect equipment there. So, you know, to be TBD to figure out the exact economics, but we like the opportunity.
Great. Well, Dan, that's about all the time we have. We thank you for coming on the podcast today, and please tune in next time.